Last November, I got together with my friends Todd and Carrie Alexander, and they put on an incredible event. The first annual Grenache Fest was held in Walla Walla, Washington on November 3rd, 2023. It featured 12 Grenache wines from Washington State producers. After the seminar, which was moderated by yours truly, there was a concert featuring Stephen Malkmus from the 90s underground grunge band Pavement, M. Ward, and Mark Pickerel, who is returning this year as our musical director. It was hands down one of the best wine events I've ever attended. And it was such a success that we're doing it again this year. Save the date, November 8th, 2024. If you're a producer wanting to pour your wines, if you want to volunteer, or if you simply want to attend this year's event, go to GrenacheFest.com and sign up on our email list to be the first to know regarding all things about this year's event. Hi, I'm Marvin John Tallett, also known as MJ or the Black Wine Guy. I have worked in all facets of the wine business and have the distinction of being the world's first ever African-American fine and rare wine auctioneer. These days, I'm a journalist and podcaster, traveling the globe, having conversations with some of the most fascinating people in the world. In this show, I'm talking to the movers, shakers, and disruptors who inhabit the world of food, wine, music, and more. They'll share their experiences on how they made it, but more importantly, how they failed and got back up again. So grab a glass and let's get to it. This is Beats, Vines, and Life, where music, wine, and life collide. Hey everybody, what's up? It's your boy MJ. Welcome to Beats, Vines, and Life. My guest today is the winemaker and head honcho at Aaron Wines and
Ecoria.
Yes, Aaron Jackson. Aaron is a Central Coast native, and he began his winemaking career in the vineyards and cellars near his hometown, Macoucas, in 2000. And in 2002, while studying wine at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, he pulled together pennies from his weekend job and launched his eponymous label, Aaron Petit Sirah.
That's it, baby.
His early career was spent working with mentoring from several wineries, big boys like Saxum, Onyx, Four Vines. And he went on to earn his master's degree in Enology from the University of Adelaide in South Australia. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you, man. Happy to be here, MJ.
Dude, man, it's really cool. Glad we could get to do this.
Yeah.
You're such a chill dude. I love it. Listen, man, I like to start at the beginning.
Yeah, let's do it.
Where are you from, man?
So born and raised right here on the Central Coast, just 30 minutes from here in Paso, just over the hill. You go over the coast, basically straight west of Templeton, where we're sitting right now. You hit a little beach town called Caicos. Born and raised there my whole life. Little tiny town, 2,000 people. Great place to grow up and still live there. Two blocks from the beach where I grew up. Templeton, Paso, this was, you know, where we'd, you know, what's funny is when we were kids, the only reason we came over here was to go to the Mid-State Fair. That was
right.
The only thing.
And
wow. Like, why the hell would you go to Paso? You know, look at it now.
Yeah. It's
blown up. So
that's kind of crazy. You brought a number of wines. So what do we have in the go? What'd you pour for me first, my man?
So we're actually starting just because we're going kind of lightest to darkest. Yep. We're going to start with a little bit of Ecoria Pinot Noir. So this is called Seafarer. Mm-hmm. So this is a project that I started in 2012. And so I'm pretty excited to taste, pour for you today. Killer Pinot. It's a blend of four vineyards out on the coast between about 1 and 5 miles from the ocean. So some of the closest vineyards to the ocean anywhere in California. And just an example of just beautiful coastal Pinot Noir, fresh, bright, great purity, great acidity. I think this area is going to be a bigger conversation piece going forward because with climate change and everything happening, finding ways to moderate and mitigate climate change.
Mm-hmm.
We're lucky to live here next to the biggest heat sink on the planet, which is the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really get this great moderating effect growing that close to the ocean. So I think it's going to be a big part of the future of wine growing. So here we are.
Yeah.
Let's drink it.
Yeah. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to, I don't know. Did I meet you? I met you. I've been here. Seems like forever, but
I hung out way too many times before doing this.
Right. Before doing this. But you got your team, Nick sent me some of the wines and they're freaking sick and delicious.
Yeah.
And, I love the brightness.
Yeah,
I think lifted quality.
Yeah, I have a big admiration for kind of what I call sort of classic California Pinot Noirs.
Okay.
And that's not necessarily like the super hipster cool kid, 12.3% alcohol wines,
Yeah.
but also not the big blown out, kind of modern day,
Not the
15 plus
15 plus
wines. But
Pinot.
I go back to old, like William Selwyn, for example, and just really fell in love with some of those wines and the old Joseph Swans and stuff like that. And those
Oh,
wines are,
all Joseph Swans are amazing.
yeah. And wines, and like, ABC, Avant Clément, taste these wines, they've held up really, really well. And they're usually falling in that, mid 13s to low 14s
Yep.
kind of ripeness level. pHs are good, acidities are good. They come from great vineyard sites. Their oak usage is pretty judicious and they're generally pretty focused as far as balancing that out. And that's really what I focus to do on is express the vineyards that we have here that I think are really unique and unlike anywhere else in California. And just kind of pair those with good winemaking, clean winemaking, pretty minimalistic. I'm not going to say I'm super natty and I don't do anything, but I mean, the winemaking's pretty damn simple.
Yeah.
And we just try to make nice, clean, beautiful, well-made wines.
That's cool. So you said you grew up here, Central Coast, small town, Cayucas, beach town, surfer dude.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, if you if it's like I, the joke I make is like if you don't get into being in the ocean growing up here, mate, it's either that or you kind of get into drugs. So it was one or the other, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, from
Not a lot to do.
from an East Coast perspective, right? You look at the movies like Dogtown Z Boys, or I mean, that's kind of like it's like, or you end up, or what's the fucking one? Oh, Keanu Reeves, Point Break.
Oh, Point Break. Oh, jeez.
You've never been in Point Break. I mean, you totally have that, like.
Patrick Swayze look,
No, you're like the man of war look, like. But yeah, for us, it's like, yeah, like either doing sports or surfing or skating or both, some combination of both.
And I did all that, and here on the Central Coast, that's the lifestyle. It's what maybe, the reality is that one of the reasons I fell in love with wine and got into wine in the first place is because, and going back, this is actually a kind of a naive decision, but I was a teenager in high school and I decided I wanted to be a winemaker when I was like 16. And I didn't know why. My parents, I didn't have a grandfather or a parent that was like busting out DRC for me when I was a kid. My parents drank cheap wine because that's all they could afford. And so I grew up in a house that had wine, but not in the way other people do, not like banging ones. But I grew up in this place where I love where I lived, and I wanted to live here. This is where I wanted to be. When I was young, I said, I love this place. I love where I grew up. This is where I want to be.
So you guys, I like now all of a sudden, fucking pot owners
ruining my story, man.
Are just going off. Like this is the fourth interview of the day. They've been all quiet and shit. Now they're like, ah.
They don't like me.
Like, they know you. That's the problem. And their dad just came home. So, but this is Beats, Vines, and Life. It's your boy MJ. It's the black, I'm the black wine guy. No, that's totally cool. Like, but at 16, though, I mean, 16, dude.
And look, I didn't know that for me, it was, you're looking at life through a different lens when you're a kid. And for me, it was saying like, hey, I love where I grew up. This place is really special to me. I think I want to live here for the rest of my life, which is kind of a dumb thing to say when you're 16, because you don't know, you don't know
I
shit.
mean, is it dumb? Or I mean, I wish I had that clarity of purpose in my clarity of mind.
And I kind of I waver sometimes between saying it was a naive decision versus also saying like maybe I did have this like fucking wisdom when I was not whatever. But like I feel like I got lucky. Like I got lucky. I was lucky to grow up in a really wonderful place, and I'm still here. And that's what got me into winemaking. I thought, shit, man, what am I going to do here? There's no jobs here. All my friends are going to become electricians, contractors. They're going to be the waiter at the seafood place for the rest of their lives, And so if I wanted to stay here, I was trying to find a way to do it. And I knew a couple of people that were kind of dabbling in the wine thing back in the late 90s. And I thought maybe wine's like going to be cool. And I felt like the industry as I kind of started looking into it, it really fascinated me. And it kind of, the wine industry touches upon so many different realms. And as far as a career goes, it's like one of the most multifaceted things I think you could ever do as a career. It's really, really interesting. And so for me, it's just always, I've been lucky enough that I fell in love with that at a young age, and I just went freaking full bore for it. And here I am today. I mean, 20, whatever, 20,
I know. I mean,
25,
your boss is,
25 years later.
Yeah.
And here I am still doing it. Still like it.
So you made that decision at 16. So it was a no-brainer that you would go to Cal Poly.
Yeah, it was actually the only college I applied to.
Oh, sure.
I only applied to one. That was it. And if I could better get in.
Well, yeah.
There was no backup plan, you know?
No, I mean, but it's so funny you said that. So I used to, in another life, I was a productivity trainer, and I trained a method called the One Thing. And it's really about how people don't realize people who are really successful have the ability to focus on one thing at a time. And the sooner you can figure that out, which it seems like you did, and then to apply to one college. Now, I'm from the East Coast, so we have this little thing called the Ivy League. So I mean, I think being from California, you had pretty good odds of getting into Cal Poly. I mean, unless your SATs were like 750.
No, they weren't very good though. Good student, but I sucked the SATs. I know. I read this morning that Boston has 12 colleges. I was like, damn, just 12 colleges just in Boston.
Oh yeah,
like, damn.
Yeah.
It's so yeah, but at the same time, I checked all the boxes. You know, I didn't have money. To
go so
to
school. State school. So
I could live in my parents' place. I could commute 20 minutes to school, and it was like I could work. I was working at a winery full time, not full time, but 3-4 days a week the whole time I was in college. From the day I started college, I was already working in a winery.
Where was your first gig, man?
So my first gig was working for a buddy of mine's friend called Cayuca Cellars, just outside of town. Mm-hmm. Little old place in a funky old wine, an old dairy barn. So I worked for him for a little bit, and then 2002, my sophomore year, I got a job working for Christian Teige at Four Vines. And that's actually where we met Jamin, because Jeremy was actually working there, doing his master's at Cal Poly. So I came on as Chris Teige's first employee, hired me in 2002, and I worked for him for almost 7 years. And he and I owe him a lot of credit for really helping me get my brand started and really being an advocate for me and what I was trying to do. And a person like myself that admires ambition and wants to cultivate that. And he was great and really allowed me and helped me blossom into. No, the from an embryo into the winemaker that I am today, and then from there on out went to continue and train and work under other winemakers that further inspired my professional kind of pathway. And but that was everything in the beginning.
Yeah, and so how does what I'm just try, I'm not tripping, but I know how I kind of got my first job. I just walked up. I was into running. I went to I hung out at this running specialty shop. Did you just go to the vineyard, or it was a friend of yours, as you said?
There's a great story. So Stuart Selkirk, who was still a very good, he's actually one of my dad's best friends that gave me my first job. And the way I got that first job was, it was my high school graduation. I was graduating high school. I'm 17 years old, and we were a really small high school. I think we had 60 kids in our graduating class. So as each of us is walking
that way, just
60 kids. Yeah.
When I started, there was 290 people in my freshman class.
Yeah.
And I think we did graduate, we lost 100, but still we graduated, but there's 300 kids in my freshman class.
Yeah, we had 300 kids in our whole high school.
Yeah.
So I'm going down you're walking down the aisle in high school, and I said in my high school graduation speech that I said, I want to be a winemaker. Aaron hopes to be a freaking whatever. Famous badass winemaker someday in Paso Robles. And that's what I said. I was 17 years old. And so about 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from Stuart. Goes, hey, I was at graduation because his son's same grade, one of my best friends since we were in diapers. And he goes, hey, you said you want to be a winemaker, right? In your high school. Yeah. He's like, you want to come work for me? I was like, hell yeah, let's do it, baby. So we did it. And then from there, I met a really, really great guy, Frank Norelli. So Frank Norelli has a winery down the road here called Zen Alley. So he's actually a Pizzenti. And so his family's owned Pizzenti Winery, which is now owned by Turley. They bought it. So we're talking about one of the most old
schools. Before I want to flesh out for people who don't know, because believe it or not, fucking people around the world listen to this.
Yeah.
Pizzenti's OG Paso Robles.
Yeah, right? 1920s. It was basically York Mountain Winery. There was Pizzenti, and there was four others back in the day, right? Mm-hmm. So they're the most OG family. So Frank was the great great grandson, I think. Okay. And so he was the winemaker there, and he had his own little label called Zen Alley, which he still has down the road. Now the Pizzenti is sold. Anyway, Stuart introduced me to Frank, and I was 17, and he brought me around, and the first thing he says to me, he goes, "Boys, you got a fire under your ass. You are fired up for this." And I was an ambitious kid. And so anyway, he knew my old boss, Christian. And so Christian calls him and he's like, "Man, I'm getting my ass kicked. I need some help." And he goes, "I got the perfect guy for you. I got this young kid. He is fired up, man. This kid is passionate. He doesn't even know what he's doing yet, but he is so passionate." And he literally just, I got a phone call, random phone call from Frank. And he says, "Hey, I got this guy. You got to meet him. If you're free next Saturday, just go out to the east side of Paso." And it was like an interview, and I just walked up, met the guy, shook his hand, and I had a job. And that was it. And so it's like, it was crazy. Like,
so even like you said, the summer you graduated, summer before you go to school, you went to work.
Yeah. Yeah. I was already working Harvest before I even started my first class at Cal Poly. Because we started in, say, September, we're already picking grapes. So I was just learning as I went. And you know, I figured, like, I don't want to waste time. So I was like, if I'm going to go into college and study wine, might as well get right to it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I've gone and done, you know, a lot of education. I've done a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in winemaking. I studied it for a long time, and I'm making my own.
So, yeah, what are your degrees in specifically?
So I've got a bachelor's degree in wine and viticulture, which is basically viticulture and enology from Cal Poly.
Okay.
I was actually the very first student in their viticulture and enology program.
See, he was going to walk over that.
Yeah, well, they were creating the program when I was in school. Uh-huh. And so they were talking about having it for years, but it was like some kind of side thing. But they're competing with Fresno State and Davis. And they finally, my junior year, like, they said, okay, we finally created the major, the wine and viticulture major. And I remember they announced it in one of my classes. I walked out of my class. I walked straight to the Dean of Agriculture's office and knocked on his door. And I was like, hey, I want to be the first damn student in this program. I've been waiting 3 years for this program to start. He's like, let's get out a piece of paper. You're going to be a guinea pig. Let's do it. But I was already studying wine, and yeah, I got a master's degree at the University of Adelaide in South Australia. So I finished school. I worked full-time as an assistant winemaker.
Let's get away a timeline. So you finished school. You finished Cal Poly. When?
I finished Cal Poly 2005.
Okay, so
I was 21.
You're 21. So now we got to fucking back up even more.
Yeah.
So that I have to unfold this.
Yeah.
You were 21 when you graduated in 2005.
Yeah.
And yet, in 2002,
I was already making my own wines. Like,
which, so you're 18?
19, yes.
19.
Straight up making my own wines, like commercial. Like, it's funny. I had to go get fingerprinted.
I was going to say, like, was that legal with ATF for you to make wine?
So funny. I go get ATF fingerprints. I'm like 19.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm like, they approved all my shit.
I'm like, if the drinking age is 21, not like I get it, but like, drinking age 21 is really like,
I know. I don't know what happened, dude. There's some going on back then. Yeah, I got fingerprinted at Cal Poly in the police department. Cal Poly Police Department, university or campus police. Yeah, I did all this, did all my own paperwork, and it got legal, and I figured, like, hey, I'm going to make my own wines. Like,
Slow down. You did your own paperwork. This is, I mean, because I'm excited about this. I'm excited about every episode, but, like, now there's people out there who are like, oh, I can't make wine. And here you're a 19-year-old kid. You fucking figured it out.
I mean, this logo on this bottle right here, man. I drew this exact logo. I drew this on my college notebook and scanned it with the little flatbed scanners back in the day.
Oh, okay. I remember flatbed
scanners. I had to use a flatbed scanner. And then what I did is I got a pirated version of Adobe Photoshop off of Napster. I downloaded that, installed it on my parents' computer, and then used it to digitize the image. And this is the same logo still since that day. So it's kind of funny. It's like that. You know, back when you could get shit off Napster.
Oh,
you know?
My God.
There's a lot more than like versions of it.
No, man, I'm even then, like, I'm way older than you. So 2002, I'm like 33. All I'm doing is getting music off of Napster. I'm thinking like, oh, I can start a business.
I was a teenager. I was probably downloading some other weird shit.
I'm sure you were, but you know, I'm not going to talk about that right now. So that's what you're telling me.
I told you I had a firearm ass. I was young. I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna make wine, and I was passionate, and I knew from the get go that if I was a 19-year-old, you know, small town, you know, half Asian surfer kid from Cayucas that's gonna go out and bust bottle of my own wine and go out and walk into some wine shop or some restaurant and expect some dude to take me seriously, they're all gonna laugh in my face. And that's going to take a long time before someone's going to, like, you know, give me the time of day. And so for me, I had to be creative. I had to think, well, shit, if I walk in with a Cabernet and say, hey, I'm a, you know, the time I bought my first wine when I was 21. Hey, I'm a 21-year-old kid. I'm making my own wine and I make Cabernet Pass Robles. They're like, cool. I got 15 Cabernets on the menu. So take a hike.
Yeah.
And so I had to be creative. I said, well, I'm going to do something different. And luckily at the time when I was working for my old boss, Christian Chigi, we made a lot of Petite Syrah and I was like in love with our Petite Syrah. So I'm like, man, Petite Syrah is cool. And I was like, nobody's making Petite Syrah. And it seems like it was my favorite wine we made.
Yeah.
And it was coming from these killer old vineyards. And I was like, you know,
where Shell Creek,
this was actually out by Shell Creek, but it wasn't Shell Creek. Okay. It was actually older than Shell Creek.
Older? Wow. Yeah.
Pretty sure. It might be torn out now, but it was called Peck
Which
Ranch.
Which sucks.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, it was a commercial vineyard. Yeah. It was like, at the time, the vines were already like 50 years old. And so, I was getting this killer old vine pizza raw. And I thought, you know, this is like a white space in the market. This is something that, you know, why are people not giving any attention to Petite Sirah? And I always, you know, here I am 20-something years later, still flying the flag for Petite Sirah. And now I look back and say, you know what, I probably would have, like, made a bunch of money if I would have made Cabernet. But you know what? Here I am. This is what I do.
Like, you've got a fire. You got a passion. Like, passion is not, you know, I mean, I guess you could have a passion for making money. But, like, you know what you're doing. And I like the fact that you're like, well, you know, because you're right. Like, kid, how old are you? You're fucking 20. You can't even drink.
Yeah.
I'm going to buy your fucking cab. Like, you know, because you have, Liberty School out of, let's look at big print. Liberty School.
Yeah.
J. Lore.
Yeah.
That was in every place out here, you know. Then fuck, who was around then, man?
Those days, so Everly was around. Meridian was huge. J. Lore was huge. Justin was already big.
Yep.
This is, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, it's funny that I started my brand in 2002, because if I think about, if I just go down the list in my brain of wineries that all the wines that I love, that you love, that are around today, like almost none of them.
No one around.
None of them were around.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, there's the guys that were getting their fledgling starts.
Yeah. Because I can remember Tobin James.
Yeah.
Victor Hugo.
Yeah. Totally. Those old school.
But Justin was the big one.
Yeah.
And Liberty School. I mean, we even the East Coast, it was Liberty School was huge. It was an incredible Cabernet.
Mm-hmm.
I think it sold for about $12.
Yeah.
In like 1998, 99.
Yeah.
And I was like, Paso Robles. Like, I didn't know. I just got into wine, but like, you think of Cabernet, you thought of Napa, and then, oh no, this Liberty School is great. You know,
yeah. The people that make Petite Sirah would have been like Eos. They were making some of the best because they were getting that old brand, old fruit, or Sierra or Eos.
Yep.
And then Tobin James was probably making Petite Sirah. Peach Canyon was making Petite Sirah. Victor Hugo was around. He was making Petite Sirah, and a handful of other people. But it was pretty low key. You know, old Norman used to be out, which is a Brecken, but old Norman, he would get a little bit of Petite Sirah for Zinfandel blending. But it was a rare thing. It was an afterthought for most people. And so, you know, I wanted to do something just big and gnarly and full on, something I thought had potential. So I never forget, like, my plan worked. I walk into this first restaurant, you know, it's like, oh, hey, I make Petite Sirah. And people go, yeah. Actually don't have a Petite Sirah on the menu. So I guess I should taste your wine.
Yeah.
And I was like, boom. Yeah. Like, that was it. Yeah. Like, I could have, they told me to take a hike in it, but I was bringing something different.
Right.
And so it's no different than what people, you know, today, someone walks in the door and they says like, oh, hey, I got a fucking Sirtico from Paso. They're like, well, shit, I got to taste that. I mean, I haven't had a Sirtico from Paso, so I'm going to try that, you know?
Right.
And so in a way it worked in my favor. And so, and also I was right in predicting that, you know, I think Paso or Petite Sirah had a future.
Well, I mean, if you think, I mean, okay, yeah, shit. Now I've gotten to the drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like seventh hour of drinking since the morning, everybody.
Gotcha.
I was doing good, yeah. But I forgot, was it, who did I talk to? I don't know, it was Valia Michelle about a blend. But I was like, so we had this Zinfandel, and it wasn't, so we decided to put Petite Sirah. I'm like, yeah, just fucking read a Ridge label.
Yeah.
Zinfandel and Petite Sirah. Fucking perfect.
Yeah. Right. And that's been the tradition of Petite Sirah for many, many years. It's been the oomph. It's been the secret fixer of Napa Valley Cabernet for decades.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's like, how many 100% Cabernets are actually 20% Petite Sirah in Napa Valley?
Oh, probably a lot. Dude, a lot. And
Paso for that matter.
And when you started talking about big, ripe Pinot Noirs.
Yep.
Throw some Petite Sirah on
there.
There
you go. Yeah. We should trademark that. It's like, what do we call that? The Miomi method?
Yeah. There was fucking more. There was fucking 5%.
25%, bro. Yeah. So, but for me, it was about taking that variety that was this sort of afterthought. Because look, at the end of the day, there's a lot of blending grapes out there that are typically classified, quote unquote, as the blending grapes. But just because they're a blending grape, you know, the reason they're a blending grape is because they don't make single varietal wines very well. But I really, my goal from the get-go was to kind of change the narrative of that and realize that, you know, there has been, I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, you know, Petite Sirah was like, you know, one of the most planted varieties in California.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, talk about that, because I have some questions for that.
Oh, you go back to the Concannon days, you know, late 60s, early 70s.
Concannon, yep.
Shit, they were, I mean, those wines were, they made these big, rich, dark, hearty, long-lived reds back in the 70s, and they were like killer, and they were like really well-known.
One of the best wines I had And I don't know if best, but memorable is a good way to name wines at this point. Yeah. When I first moved out here in 1999, it was like Christmas Eve. I was working at the Wine Bistro down in Montecito, which is no longer there. But anyway, and we had people would consign wines. Someone had consigned a wine, and it was a 76 Ridge
yep.
York Creek.
York Creek.
Petite yep. Syrah. Mm-hmm. So 76, 99, 23 years old.
Yep.
Black as fuck.
Yep.
Amazing wine.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing wine. And then also, when I worked in New York, I loved, like, the Robert Bialy Petite Syrah.
Great stuff. Still love that stuff.
The Turley, Hayne Vineyard,
Rattlesnake's killer.
Petite Syrah. Yeah, and you're right. Petite Syrah, I talk about this too a lot. I was like, probably one of my least favorite red varietals is Cabernet Sauvignon because it's just so widely planted.
Yeah.
And it's planted, and sadly, it's planted for commercial purposes, not terroir and sense of place purposes, mm-hmm. right? So, like you said, so you had in Napa, Judgment of Paris was great for American wines, but it fucked up. People just ripped up old vines in, old vine Petite Syrah, and put in Cabernet.
Yeah.
You know? And you get a... What's the oldest Petite Syrah you've had?
When I was at Concannon for a conference years ago, speaking on a panel, they busted out some magnums of some Petite Syrahs from, I think, like 69, 1970, 71. It's surprising they were in Livermore Petite Syrahs. Dude, honestly, these wines were still solid. I was very impressed.
It's so funny because, Livermore Valley is not even like, that's how well suited for California that variety is. Yeah. I mean, Livermore, there's great wines in Mirror as well, but again, and then you throw it a fucking Magnum, that's got to be insane.
I had some old York Creeks and Ridge that were solid. It's a great story about a bottle of wine that someone gave me a while back, and Jeremy's not in here right now, but a great one I got a long time ago that blew my mind was a 1980 something bottle of Trader Joe's Petite Syrah. I don't even know when Trader Joe's launched. But it was literally like a Trader Joe's labeled Petite Syrah from Napa Valley from like the 80s, like the early 80s. And someone's like, hey, I had this. You want it? I was like, fuck, are you kidding me right now? It was so classic. It was cool. And I'm solid still. I couldn't believe it.
Wow, that's insane.
Yeah, Trader Joe's. I love that.
So you had a kind of vision. And I love that you're saying like, yeah, like you needed to be different. And inside of the passion and love we offer, it is a business. And like, I just like at such a young age, how did you think to be like, is it like you said, you're like, it's half Asian kid. Did you just think different? I mean, like,
I think I would say like my ambition led me to try to think creative and think out of the box. It's kind of who I am. It's like, I'm a good problem solver. And, and I was trying to, every time I think of something, I try to usually twisted and turned on its head a little bit. And so for me, even at that young age, I wanted to be successful, but I'm not that naive. Like, I know how hard it is to start any kind of business, whether you're trying to make freaking, socks with poodles on, or you want to make wine, whatever it is. And so I was trying to be creative and I had a passion, and Petite Syrah caught my attention. And so the more I looked at it, the more I kind of just saw opportunity. And I went down that road. I didn't have any money. I was broke. So I was working at a place in Cambria here, west of here, an oyster bar called the Sea Chest. And I was working. I was 19. I was, saving my money. It was a busboy. So we had a place that's super busy. So in the summertime, of course, end of summer, I had like, I had more than $1,000 in tips, like stuffed under my pillowcase, my parents' house. And I was like, all right, here we go, baby. Like, I got a grand. I got $1,000, back then. My first grapes, $900 a ton.
Mm.
Petite Syrah, $900 a ton. Went and got three neutral barrels. Couldn't afford any new wood. So I got three neutral barrels, $900 a ton. My friend's dad let me crush the grapes and store them at his place. Made my first vintage. At that time, I was working at Four Vines, saving my money. I got my first glass and corks I forego a paycheck so I could just get some of their glass from them. And so I took, they gave me, a couple bags of corks. Bottled that first 75 cases, and I went out and I hand-sold, hand-labeled, hand-wax-dipped every single bottle in my parents' garage. And then went out and sold that wine to everyone that I knew for $100 a case. Had 75 cases. So all of a sudden I had like $7,000 and I turned $1,000 into $7,000. And I was like, all right, here we go. But it took me like 2 years to release it. Mm-hmm. So then after I, you know, the two vintages after that, I actually couldn't make, I had to make less wine because I didn't have any money, you know? So the first year I made 3 barrels and I could only make 2 barrels the next year and the year after that. And then in 05, after I got my money from selling my 2002, I was able to like get a little bit more seed money, but I just grew it like that steady the whole time. I never had an investor or no family money or no, I just been chipping away at it for 20 something years.
Fuck.
Because the bank won't loan money to your kid, right? You're like, oh, I'm going to have a loan. And I'm like, what are your assets? I'm like, I got student loan debt. Is that an asset?
Have you heard Neil Brennan used to write with Dave Chappelle? He has, no. he has a skit about why college is a scam. He's like, if you're 18 years old and here you are,
yeah,
ambitious,
yeah,
have a vision,
yeah,
have a plan. I can do this.
Yeah.
You could, like I said, you could walk into a bank like, hey, listen, I'm going to start a winery. I'm really, you know, I'm from here. I'm 16. I know I want to make wine.
Yeah.
So listen, I you know, I want to start this wine. I want to start a wine, a winery called, my name's Aaron. We call it Aaron, yeah, you know? You know, I figure I need about $120,000 to get it going. I got to get barrels. I got to do this. I got to do four. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah. They go, are you out of your fucking mind?
Yeah.
But if you go, hey, listen, I want to hang out with my friends for 4 years, get blackout drunk.
Yeah.
Party.
Yeah.
You know, road trip all around the state, you know, maybe go down to Mexico for spring break. You can have this student loan.
Yeah, absolutely. I know.
But you can get a small business loan, but they'll give you fucking money.
Oh, yeah. You want this car? You drive this $80,000 truck? Yeah. Right. Can I give you my dime? No, here's the keys. Take the car.
But like you said, hey, this is my dream. I'm going to fulfill it. Sorry, kid. We don't finance dreams.
No.
We finance debt.
And it's funny. I speak to a lot of young people today. I love mentoring young students, and I go speak at Cal Poly in classes all the time, and you know, try to make sure I hire them for interns. And I always ask the class, like, how many of you all want to feel like you want to have your own label one day or have your own winery? And it surprised me a lot of students that raise their hands. And so I see that the kids have those dreams. You know, they want to do it. And I'm there to tell them, like, hey, like, what I do in my company is, like, whoever works for me, I try to support them and support their dreams and pay it forward the same way that my old boss did to me. So everyone that works for me gets to make their own wine for free. And if you're an employee of mine, you get to make your wine here for free. I'm like, whatever I can do to help you and get you going. That's what happened to me. And like, it's my responsibility to pay it forward. But at the same time, I do warn them that the landscape of starting a winery today is very different than the reality of I had about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy how much it's changed. I mean, the real estate prices and the cost of grapes and the cost mm-hmm. of this and the competition. I mean, we talked about this earlier, but the amount of wineries that were in Paso Robles 20 years ago was mm-hmm. an infinitesimal fraction mm-hmm. of what it is today. Mm-hmm. So the competition's steep, and the majority of people that are up in this business, you know, they got a hell of a lot more resources.
Right. And the flip side is people like who love wine and made a lot of money in something else. I'm like, oh, I'm going to have wine now. Right. And they have money to burn, for lack of a better term.
They do. But some of those people have done amazing things, past rebels. So yeah, I don't want to
No,
but at the same time, like when you are a small business owner, there is a reality to the fact that, but your competition has a lot more means than you, and some of the only ways to overcome that is ambitious and tenacity.
Yeah,
and that's what I had. I mean, I was
you have that.
I was tenacious. Space, I was like, looking back at myself now, and I was like, man, I had balls when I was young. Like, I would march into places and just walk. And who's the wine buyer? I got a wine. I want them to taste it. They're like, they're in the back. I'm like, well, can I? I'm just hanging out here at the bar until they come out and taste my wine. I'm like 22 years old doing this. And I'm like, fuck, I wouldn't do that now. I'm all like, oh, okay, I'll come back later. I'll send them 16 emails and get rejected. Maybe they'll taste my wine eventually, you know? But yeah, I was like, damn, man. But that's what it took, you know? That's what it took.
Question about, so you said tenacity, persistence, but also, I want to understand what your parents did. Like, Were they 9-to-5 employees? And was any one of them entrepreneurs? Like, where does this kind of drive come from? You said grandparents have money, but like somebody, there's some hard work and tenacity and creativity in your DNA. Where did that come from?
I, I don't know. I used to talk to my therapist about it. Probably said little brother syndrome, you know? It's like my older brother was like valedictorian, handsome, top of the class, you know, star athlete, whatever he did, whatever. And it's like maybe it was that little brother in me that was just like, fuck you, man. I'm a like, you know, we used to have those really, you know, my brother and I are super tight. We used to have those kind of fun competitions. But no, I you know, I came from, my mother's born and raised in Hawaii. She, you know, moved here from Hawaii, moved to California from Hawaii in the late 60s. Early 70s, and my, you know, I grew up in a family with your kind of standard family, you know. No one in my family has like never had any money. Mm-hmm. Did not come from family entrepreneurs. In fact, I was talking to my wife yesterday that I think at least of my father's generation, because he had brothers, and then my wife's parents and her generation, like I'm actually the first business owner of all of them. Wow. But my grandfather, who I never knew, he passed away when my dad was only 16, but he had like a print shop.
Okay.
It printed like whatever brochure, like whatever in the 50s. Mm-hmm. Right? But yeah, I didn't come from a family of entrepreneurs. My parents, my mom, you know, my whole life was just like, go get a public job. Go do something.
Oh yeah. Like, get a job. Like, go work for the government.
Yeah. 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 Totally. Like, and I was like, no mom, like I'm
a got insurance.
And that's the thing.
It's a track. You're level one, you're level two, you know, just 25 years, you're moving 25 levels. Yeah.
And they supported my ambition.
Right.
But they were, you know, they don't understand the world of entrepreneurship. And so it's scary for them. And so I was the first of my generation. I didn't grow up in a family that had money or means or drink wine. So, I don't know where it came from, but I just said, fuck it, I just went for it, you know, and,
so, you know, when you drink wine, it was just because you live close to wine country.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's funny. Like when I was even making wine already, like when I was 19 making wine, I'm perfectly honest, man. I didn't even really like wine. I was fascinated with my first job was working in a vineyard when I was 16, and I got a job planting a vineyard here, over here between Paso here and the coast, planting some Pinot. And then we got to ride around on quads and plant vines. And I kind of fell in love with this idea with, you know, as I'm putting a vine in the ground, installing drip hose, you know, and trying to grasp like what the hell it was that I was doing. So at that point, I didn't have the context. I didn't really understand how wine was made, but it was really trying to understand like, hey, I'm going to put this plant in the ground right now. And this site that has been chosen, this soil type, this aspect, this rootstock, this clone of Pinot Noir, whatever, is I'm going to put this vine in the ground. We're going to nurture, we're going to care for this vine for 3 years. It's going to throw its first crop. Then someone's going to pick those grapes. They're going to make this strange thing my parents drink. They're going to store it in barrels. They're going to age it. And, someday it'll get bottled, and maybe that wine will end up, you know, in someone's cellar in New York across the country. And it may be shit 10 years later or something. Some guy, girl's going to open this bottle of wine and look at the label and say, okay, here's a, you know, 1998 Pinot Noir from so-and-so vineyard grown on these soils, and sit there and taste it and appreciate it and think about that place. And there was a direct correlation to that moment, which could be shit. It could be 2 years later. It could be 2 decades later. There's a direct correlation between that moment and me putting the vine in the ground to grow those grapes. And when I thought about it that way, fuck, brain just exploded. Like, holy shit. Like, what else, realistically, what else do we as human beings on this planet, as consumers of things, on a minute by minute basis, what else has that kind of linear connection and that kind of storyline?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I try to think about this all the time, and I don't like it's, there's nothing else. I mean, people go like, oh, I got like, I'm wearing like a Patagonia jacket. It's like, oh, cool. Like I believe in the brand, but like, they don't know where the freaking goose feathers come from. They don't know where the factory is. Where they don't know like what the weather was like when they, you know, when they were, you know, what the rainfall levels were, what the geese ate. People are like, oh, I love Neiman Ranch steak. Neiman Ranch steak's like, oh dude, Neiman Ranch. Like that's the shit. Yeah. Where's Neiman Ranch? They're like, what kind of cows do they raise? Where do they feed the cows? How much rainfall was there last year when they, you know, it's like,
beef wine cows. Has,
yeah. And so, you know, with something like wine, like the story, it just goes so deep that we sit around at freaking midnight with 16 bottles of wine on the table, talking like a bunch of idiots. And the only end of wine, someone walks in the door, like, what the hell are you guys talking about? Mm-hmm. I mean, people love it that much. They go so deep that people start fucking podcasts to talk about it all day, for 80 minutes.
I mean, it's like, well, what the fuck can I talk about? What do I love talking about? And how can I learn about people?
Yeah.
But no, that's the fucking thing. And before we were talking about mutual friends of ours, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, there's a wine culture everywhere, but like, there's some cowboys here, Paso Robles, who like, I'm like, that means those motherfuckers were drinking for like 48, 52 hours straight.
Yeah. I ain't in that camp at all, but yeah, no, but those guys are champions.
Yeah. But what else? And yes, I know, you know, we just came off of January. Yes, it's alcohol. It's a toxin. There's alcohol, but like most people who are doing that, it's just like, it's cause it just feeds it. Like the energy just happens. It's like, wait, what's that? And you go back to that wine, like I said, and what's this? And what's that? You graduate in 05, was it?
05. And I released, I just released my first wine.
Okay.
I actually wrote my senior project at Cal Poly on my own winery, but I turned in a bottle of my first commercial vintage to my teacher. I wrote a business plan for my degree, and I handed it to him, and I said, by the way, my business plan's already in market. Here's the bottle. It's kind of an easy A.
That's insane.
Yeah. And I graduated at 21. I graduated early.
And then when did you go right to Australia? You
hung
right?
No, okay. I worked as a full-time assistant winemaker here.
Who'd work?
I was at Four Vines, still the place I worked in college. Okay. I went straight away. Like literally graduated. I took a week off.
Okay.
When I graduated, and I was worked full-time Monday after 1 week after I graduated, started my own, working on my own brand, growing that up and then worked there for 2 years. And then was kind of thirsty for, you know, I grew up here my whole life, and I made a promise to myself when I was young that I would live at least at one point in my life, live in another country. I didn't want to be a kid like that grew up in a small town like this, even though it's obviously the place that I want to live the rest of my life. But I don't want to say like, oh, I never left, you know. Yeah. If anything, I looked around every day at the people in my town that I grew up with, and I could see the people that never left. It's like, oh shit, like I want to be the person like never left. I could be here forever, but. And so I made a promise to myself that I wanted to live in another country. And so I was thirsty for more knowledge. I wanted to, you know, again, still being ambitious. I just wanted to learn more. I'm a lifelong learner.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started looking around at graduate schools. I looked at the University of Adelaide because at the time they were pumping out the best wine research that I was reading. It was all coming out of Australia.
Really?
They had good government support in the early 2000s. Their wine industry was just killing it. They were making tons of money.
Oh yeah, I mean that was the height of the Grateful Palate,
yep.
The Australian Wine Grateful Collection. Palette.
Molly Duker was killing it.
Yeah, it was like Paca and the Americans love the big wines.
Yeah, you know, yeah. But they were smart. I mean, you think about the Yellowtail days, a brand that you know did what people always say now in every marketing conference is meet consumers where they're at, right? Well, Yellowtail just reverse engineered it and said, why don't we just make what people want to drink?
Mm-hmm.
And that was like that blew the freaking doors off of the wine industry, because before that it was like you were expected to learn to like the wines that were already being made. Well, this is the way they're made. You're not sophisticated if you don't like.
Well,
them.
I mean,
they weren't consumer friendly.
Right.
They're like, you know, you're talking like 80s and 90s. You know, Napa Cabernet. We're talking tannic as hell. American oak, bready.
Italian wines. Italian wines. Barolo. No, you have to wait 40 years to drink it. Like, you buy wine, like, you might even get to fucking taste it.
Yeah. And so.
And they were fine with that.
Yeah. And so it was. So anyway, they were geniuses, and they were pumping out great research, enological research, studying viticulture. They were already on top of climate change way back then.
Mm-hmm.
They were already, I know, when people.
And closures.
Closures, they're on top of closures. They were studying all that shit. I mean, when we had all the fires a couple of years ago all over California, everyone was looking, figuring out what to do. They were all going and referencing Australian research that was a decade old that they had all done on fires. They were so tip of the spear. So I was like, that's where I'm going. I'm going to kill two birds with one stone. I'm going to go live in another country. I was going to either go there. I was going to go to France. Didn't speak French. And I was like, I don't know. That's going to be a good call for me from an educational standpoint.
And you could surf in Australia.
Yeah. Actually, not really where I lived, actually, believe it or not. I didn't live really close to the ocean.
Yeah. I mean, think about
Australia. That wasn't the goal.
But yeah, but like, so yeah, that's going to be kind of far. So, you go to school there, and same deal. You end up with internships or
no? Actually, only did my master's. I had to fly back home to work on my own wines. I made my own wines the whole time, so I had to fly back home like every 6 weeks. So I was
how long is that flight?
16 hours. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my mom's friend, her husband was a pilot for United, so she'd get me standby tickets. It was like $650 round trip for me to fly back from Adelaide. So I was just milking that relationship for 2 years. And coming back, and every single school break that I had to come home or even take time off school because I was still doing my business for most.
Because you actually were living it.
I was living. I was selling wines.
You already had a brand.
Yeah, already. I mean, it was small. It was like 400
doesn't matter
400 cases, but
it's
I was
a brand.
Yeah, I was doing it,
and it's
I was
business.
I learned a lot. And it was, that was before like remote work, as we call it today. It was like a thing, you know, like I'm trying to figure this out, but it was a great learning experience. I love my time in Australia. Was one of the greatest moments of my entire life. I look back and I go back all the time. Some of the best friends in my life are still there. Love the place, love the people. Adore it. And yeah, it was a great time. Came back and just jumped straight back into my career working with people and you know, making my own wines and slowly chipping away at this winery.
What's next, man?
So
you get me all banged up.
We'll start with the blend. This is actually the first blend that I ever made. I started making this in 2010.
Okay.
So for the first, from 2002, which was my first vintage, up until 2009, I only made one wine every year. Well, I take that back. I didn't quite make one wine, but I would only make Petite Sirah.
Okay.
There was years that I would make some of the second tier, like a second Petite Sirah. Mm-hmm. But basically what I would normally do is I would buy fruit, get all my barrels together, and then I'd make, say, at this point, maybe I'm making 10, 15 barrels of wine. And at that point, I would basically just select like my top 8. And I would usually bulk the rest. You know, this time I had someone that had no fucking money. But I was just like, I'm only going to bottle like the best thing I got. And I had wineries here in Paso Robles that no matter what, I'd just call them up and say, hey, I got 8 barrels of Petite Sirah. They would just buy them in a second. You know. And I was trying to always put my best foot forward, wanted to have that integrity. And then eventually in 2010, I decided like I didn't want to just make one wine. And so I started branching out and I started making a blend. My first blend, this blend's called Trespasser. And so I've been making this wine since 2010. We actually just did a library tasting the other day of a Trespasser going back to the first vintage. And what it is it's a blend that's based around Petite Sirah and Mourvèdre generally.
Mm.
So this is actually Petite Sirah, Syrah, and Mourvèdre. There's actually a blend at 25% Mourvèdre in it, but the Mourvèdre varies between about 25 and 30% every year. So pairing that big, rich, dark fruit, that tannic structure, that really black fruited character of Petite Sirah with that awesome, savory kind of feral thing that we all love about Mourvèdre, that mm-hmm. great length. I'll never forget when I was working at Saxham years ago and Justin Smith, who I know you just interviewed, he's a great, good friend and a great mentor of mine. But he was explaining Mourvèdre to me in a wine. He goes, well, you know, and we're talking like your traditional GSM. Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, Mourvèdre's the base. Think about it. It's like, Mourvèdre's the base. Like, what's Grenache? It's obvious. It's the treble. I mean, it's just all high tone. Boom, in your face, bright. Boom, jumps out of the glass. It's like, it sings in a wine. You put in GSM, it's GS. Grenache is front and center, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Syrah is totally the mid. It builds the structure around the wine. It holds the whole thing together, you know, just like the mid does in a song. And then what's the bass? So Mourvèdre's like the bass. It sits in the background. It's hiding back there. You're not really paying attention to it. You almost don't even know it's there. But what it gives is it gives dimension and it gives length. Huge length, huge dimension. And then kind of like bass, if you take it out of the song, it's like, what the hell just happened? Where'd it go? Like something's missing. It's like it's almost so subtle you didn't even know it was there. Then you take it away, you're like, oh, shit. Now the song sucks. So Mourvèdre has this tremendous supporting role in a wine that I love. And it's one of my favorite wines we're tasting out of the cellar. It's like we get to the Mourvèdre and we're always like, fuck, these are good. Like, yeah. And so it's fun to, you know, everything I do under the Aaron brand, make 5 different wines, and all these are studying, okay. They're all studying Petite Sirah. So okay. It's taking Petite Sirah and pairing them in different dimensions and versions, more or less, of how Petite Sirah plays nice with other varieties. And so Mourvèdre and Petite Sirah have a kind of a cool natural affinity. Again, going back to what you said about Ridge, you know, those old Ridge wines. I mean, there's Zin, there's Mataro, there's Petite Sirah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, like, shit, not trying to throw shade or anything, but like, the whole notion of the red blend being a new category of wine is fucking ludicrous.
It is.
He didn't show up in the kitchen, did he? No.
No.
but because Bordeaux was red blends. Chateau Neuf is red blends. You know, Rioja, mm-hmm. red blends. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mixed blacks
mm-hmm.
was the standard in California. Really, yep. It's Zinfandel, Petite Sirah, Alicante Boucher, Mataro.
Fuck, if you had Morgan Twain Pearson on here, you'd go on the list, would go on.
Oh, yeah.
You get Tegan Pasalacqua on here. Yeah. He's going to tell you like 60 varieties.
I'm trying to get, Tegan, we're trying to hook up with him in New York. Morgan. Yeah. Maybe Paso. I mean, maybe Hospice. But yes, yeah. Those guys were. But like, literally, like the notion that a certain that red blends became that's insane. That was how wine was made.
Let's dig in on this a little bit, because this is a big part of what I talk about with Petite Sirah, which is that, you know, one of the reasons that I have an admiration for working with variety and why it's fun is because the potential is there. But if you think about it, you know, people go, what are the challenges of Petit Sirah? And I honestly tell people, well, I do believe that making a complete wine, what we consider a complete wine mm-hmm. as winemakers out of mm-hmm. Petit Sirah is very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. You can make a big freaking in your face tannic, you know, piece of shit wine that's square as hell. And yeah, it'll last for 40 years. It doesn't mean it's a joy to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think about it, like, well, what are wines that historically were not single varietals and were always bolstered by other varietals? Freaking Cabernet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how many 100% Cabernets really
come out of Bordeaux? You don't see No.
They don't because...
Maybe second or third label because they had leftovers.
Because they don't believe it makes a complete wine.
Exactly.
On its own.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the... But now what we've learned is that, and we have Napa to thank for this, is their obsession with making varietal wines. They're almost having tunnel vision, so to speak, you know, putting guardrails on what they want to do mm-hmm. and being focused on Cabernet has allowed them to refine farming and refine winemaking in a way that now we do taste wines that are 100% Cabernet that are complete wines, you know, but that wasn't the way Cabernet was in Napa Valley in the 60s and 70s and 80s. These were very square wines, very tannic, not a lot of mid palate, very disjointed structures. And so what other varieties can be like that? Petit Sirah. It can be a big, square, tannic, mm-hmm. burly wine with not a lot of mid-palate. You can make that quite easily. But to refine the wine, work in the vineyards, find the right terroir, work from the ground up to make a wine that can be a complete wine and stand on its own as a single varietal and stand with some of the best is really challenging. And with Petit Sirah, there ain't a lot of people doing it. So it's sometimes I feel like an island. I'm out there going like, shit, I'm out there flying the flag for something no one cares about.
Mm-hmm.
But every time I make a Petit Sirah and make a great one, I feel like I get to be, and this sounds like an egotistical thing to say, but I feel like I get to be part of writing the story of Petit Sirah.
No, I know. Listen, I mean, it says on your guys' website, the question is, how can we write a new story for Central Coast wine and how do we unlock its potential? And for you, it was started with Petit Sirah.
That's the lens through which I work. That's the instrument. That's the instrument that I play.
Yeah.
You know, as I and if we think about all other wines that we all enjoy and love, most wines that we drink, let's say more than 90% of them, have an international benchmark mm-hmm. somewhere.
Exactly. Yes.
Where's the international benchmark for Petit Sirah?
You know what? Pause. This is a perfect place to take a quick break because I had a question in my head and you're so prolific and so engaging. So I don't want to jump in. So this is perfect time to take a quick break. So we're going to be right back with more of Aaron Jackson and we're going to find out where the benchmark in the world is for Petit Sirah. So we'll be right back.
Hey, I don't know if I told you guys this earlier, but last year Grenache Fest sold out within 72 hours. So, if you want to be there on November 8th, 2024, make sure that you go over to GrenacheFest.com and sign up for the email list so you will be the first to know when tickets go on sale. I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. This was a one-of-a-kind wine and music festival like no other I've ever seen before. Don't miss out. Go to GrenacheFest.com for more information.
Okay, we're back. So, talk to me, because the question I had. So we're gonna stick a pin. We put it in the part. Let's stick a pin. Like, the question I had. So first of all, what's the difference between Petit Sirah and Sirah?
Oh shit, are we gonna do that? We
can
do this.
We have to do that because there is a.
We start from the beginning.
Because Sirah, you're looking at Coronas, you're looking at Hermitage, right?
Right.
Right. You know, Grenache. We just for Grenache, you're looking at Chardonnay. Yeah. Yeah. And I love Chardonnay, but really the benchmark would be Chardonnay, right?
Yeah.
But like Petit Sirah is like well, what? And then it's not spelled the same way as Sirah.
No, it's not. And the story around Petit Sirah's history is really funny.
And then where does Durif?
So Durif and Petit Sirah are the same thing.
Come in.
Yeah. I used to fight people when I lived in Australia. They just tried to disagree with me. They were the same. And it's like, hey man, you know, they did the research, you know, at Davis. You know, it's like it's freaking Durif, man. It's the same thing. But this variety, you know, it came from the south of France originally. So Francois Durif was the botanist that created this,
mm-hmm.
and he was trying to make a variety that was resistant to downy mildew, which we don't really have here in California. They do; it's really common in France, but he was trying to make a variety resistant to downy mildew. So he was crossing varieties, and he ended up crossing a variety. But I think at the time he didn't actually know what he had crossed,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately, I don't recall off the top of my head if it was an accidental cross. I believe it was an accidental cross, but
most shit is.
Yeah. So they didn't know what it was. And, anyway, it ends up in cuttings that end up here, but old Italians, and ends up coming from the south of France and landing in, you know, Sonoma County and places like that and getting planted. And the reason they call it a Petite Syrah is because it frankly looks like Syrah, specifically okay. The vine and the ampelography. So if you look at the vine, look at the kind of leaf, the way the leaves are shaped, it's less vigorous than Syrah. It has kind of similar leaves, although the leaves are more dark green rather than pale green like Syrah can be. But there's some similar aspects to it. And does the clusters look like Syrah? Kind of.
Okay.
You know, they can look really, really similar. And when they do look similar to Petite Syrah, or to Syrah, is the berries do actually tend to be small. Petite Syrah can also have really big berries. So can Syrah. Okay. But anyway, they sort of slang called it Petite Syrah, and those people definitely had no idea that it was actually a crossing of Syrah. So it was years, years, years later, Carol Meredith at UC Davis discovered that it was actually a crossing of Syrah in Pellercine. And Pellercine is pretty much gone. There's a couple vines in the
bedrock. Randy Dunn has some up on Howell Mountain.
Uh-huh.
And of course, Morgan.
Yeah, Morgan's got some in the bedrock vineyard. So, you know, those guys that are pros have been able to identify it. And, you know, as far as we know, Petite Syrah wasn't ever really cultivated in the south of France. You know, so really it was just mostly adopted here. And then there's various plantings of it in Australia, in Israel, and Mexico. Back in the
I've had Petite Syrah from Mexico.
Yeah, Val de Guadalupe. Yeah, they have Petite Syrah. They have old vines down there, and so it was just this kind of, you know, strange story.
So that's important because for the wine geeky people, but also so we're talking like so for Merlot it's the right bank of Bordeaux.
Yep.
For Cabernet Sauvignon, it's the left bank, even though we just talked about blends, right? For Malbec, it's Cahors. Sorry, Argentina.
It is.
Right. I mean, I love Argentina, but let's we talk about this, right? And it's like meeting people where they're at, and it's great. Argentina Malbec came on the market at a great time.
Yeah,
and you know, great market. For Sauvignon Blanc, it's the Loire Valley.
Yeah.
Sorry, New Zealand, even though you kill it.
Yeah.
You know, Marble's amazing. You know. Pinot Noir, it's fucking, and Chardonnay, it's Burgundy.
Burgundy.
Okay. Yeah. Because, you know, I know the Darif, but people don't know what I know, and we're just having a good time kicking it. What is the benchmark for Petite Syrah?
That's the best question I posed to you, is where would you say it is?
So for me, you know, the first Petite Syrah, I'm pretty sure I had was like, it was either a Bialy or a Turley, and it was Napa Valley, and it was most likely mountain fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. Somewhere in Napa Valley on a mountain.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I think about the old vineyards that inspired me back in my early days. You know, you look at places like Tolman Station, Gallo owns it, you know, behind Louis and Martin.
Oh, yeah.
So, right.
There. I've had a Petite Syrah from there.
Yeah. Tolman Station. I mean, they actually. Poor Gallo's actually yanked out most of the vineyard. I mean, you know, they have obviously have their reasons, but that was a classic vineyard there.
Yeah.
You know, the old Hayden Vineyard's a good example of one. York Creek from, you know, on Spring Mountain.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I don't even know who makes that anymore. And the list goes on and on and on. You go to old places in Sonoma County, and there's some really, really wonderful old wine vineyards there. Lytton Springs has got a lot of
Lytton Springs,
Petite Syrah from there, and obviously you got to go back.
I mean, and I don't know how, but you'll find some up in Lake and Mendo.
Lake and Mendo, you know, here and there. Yeah. You know, it's kind of rare.
But for the benchmark, you know, and it is. It's like Napa. It is the people who preserve these old vines in Napa.
Calistoga, Frediani.
Yeah.
You know, like, and realistically, if we're really just going to, you know, really nail it down, I mean, I guess in a way we have to say that, and I don't want to say necessarily that it's the benchmark, but the place that where you would first create a benchmark for a Petite Syrah would have been the Napa Valley, because they're really the area where you truly see you know, single varietal old vine
plantings
of Petite Syrah. Mm-hmm. You see them in Sonoma as well, but they're oftentimes very much intermixed between other Zinfandel vineyards and other varieties. So
yeah,
when you go to Napa that you see, and God, there's very few of them left because they're tearing off for Cabernet, but old single vineyard, old vine single vineyard Cabernets, you know, and that's the benchmark. But realistically, I mean, people have only been making single varietal Petite Syrahs
since like for the last 50 years.
Yeah.
So like that's, I mean, how's that in the story of wine? That's right. Nothing.
That's nothing.
It's a millisecond.
There's in case you never heard this book called The Bible. The wine was in the Bible.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And so it's for something to be around for that long and 50 years, it's like 5 seconds in millisecond and then like,
oh yeah,
throughout how long wine's been around.
Yeah. You go to places in Europe and they're like, oh yeah, my family's been farming grapes here for 500 years.
Exactly.
And you're like, cool.
Yeah. You're like, damn. See?
Yeah. I'm the ninth generation, you know? So for me, one of the things that's been really great about kind of having this obsession and this drive towards Petite Syrah as a grape is that I'm comfortable with the unknown. I'm a lifelong learner, and this grape provides me that ability to be part of writing the story of what great Petite Syrah is. I'm not trying to copy anybody. Even those benchmark wines that I talk about,
right.
I don't sit down and taste those wines and be like, how do I make this? How do I make that wine? I don't do that. You know, I explore, you know, every vintage to me, every wine is a new way for me to learn the variety and learn more about wine and see the world through that lens. And speaking of that, of course, Petite Syrah, you know.
Yeah.
So, it's been one of the reasons why I get a great joy in doing what I do.
I mean, one thing I would tell you, when you look at the color on fucking Petite Syrah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if your Petite Syrah is in the dark, you're definitely doing something.
I mean, it exactly. Like it literally is.
That's the easy part.
It's intoxicating. The color's intoxicating. Like, you're like, mmm.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, for Black Wine Guy podcast, this is the blackest of black.
Yeah.
We're talking
about
black color, black fruits, you know, all the flavors are dark. You know, good Petite Syrah should have black pepper, should have tar, you know, black asphalt, should have black fruit, blackberry, you know, black plums, like all those flavors.
Black figs.
Yeah.
It's all in there, man. Mm-hmm. Black olives. I mean, it's all in there. Yep. I mean, it's black as fuck. Shit. Just the nose.
Just 2021. Yeah.
Okay.
Great vintage.
Yeah.
Not the biggest, you know, 21's one of my favorite vintages ever. I mean, it's definitely not the biggest of big vintages compared to, you know, other vintages in the past. We've had wines that, you know, vintages are probably made, and this is a fucking huge wine, but we've had wines that made, vintages that made bigger wines, but this wine just has a lot of refinement to it. It's a big mouthful of wine. It's a blend of about six different vineyards in Petite Syrah world. So I do believe, you know, actually never made a single vineyard Petite Syrah. It's hard to make.
Never? Oh, wow.
No. And that's why I have a lot of admiration for people like Turley and so on and so forth that make these single vineyard Petite Syrahs because, you know, I'll put our Petite Syrah up against anyone's in the world. That's easy to say when most people only make it in California.
but look at who's making it. I mean, right, like
it's a star-studded
cast. We talked about benchmark, and then you know, and like you go up to Napa, and then like in my neck, but there's, you know, you might slide up into Pride, and they have a Petite Syrah, and they're like, they made, you know, like I mean, it's like, I think it's a grape that people who really dig wine will feel like want to fuck with, like just because it's so dark and it's you know, tannic, and it can be long lasting. But, you know, but then you have like, so you had Concannon.
Yeah.
And you know who else is fucking killer? Petite Syrah. Mm-hmm. And I loved it back in the day. Fopiano.
Oh, yeah. They're actually Petite Syrah's super solid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I trade bottles with their winemaker and no, they make some.
And I'm talking, I haven't had like their good bottle. I had their commercial bottle. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm sure they have like the ultra fucking reserve.
Yeah. They got an old fine one that they make from some selection that's actually pretty killer. It's Russian River. It's cooler. It tends to be a little bit more red fruited. I mean, it's black fruited still, but a little bit more red fruited, but no, it's killer. And there's so many
David Bruce Petite Syrah.
Yeah. There's so many examples of great old vine Petite Syrahs out there. And, you know, Petite Syrah, Paso Robles, this is my home. This is my love. Yep. Like, this is where I grew up. So I'm committed, but man, have I not had the itch to like call some of those guys up and be like, will you sell me some Petite Syrah?
I mean, you know, you should fuck around with something, man.
I mean,
I don't know anybody ringing the Petite Syrah. I don't know anybody ringing the Petite Syrah, but you know, bell like you do. You
know? Yeah, I know.
You went. I mean, you went all fucking in.
Yeah, I'm all in on it, man. Yeah. It's fun. It's actually cool to see other winemakers now embracing it. Saxon, for example, Lennox Toledo, some of these local guys here.
Cinnabon and Flannis, they put in there. Yeah,
Manfred's like, hell yeah. You
know? So it's like, in a way, it's like, oh, I feel.
But they don't do, you know, they don't do 100%. No. I mean, but like I interviewed Jess and I was like, what the fuck is up with Hex? Mm-hmm. Like the Hex is heavy petite Syrah. And I think, I forget it was a Tipperino, but like I had a bottle, I got two bottles of Hex and a Magnum. And like, I opened a Hex, I've had it for a year. And I'm like, called Donnie, like, yo, he's like, yo, just pull the cork. I opened that bottle and no, I actually didn't call him first. And like, I opened it, decanted it. 2 hours later, drank it, and I was like, dude, what's up with this one? He's like, yeah, we haven't figured out. That wine's weird. We can't figure it out. Like, it was so backward. And because
Petite Syrah can be really backward. It
wasn't bad. It was like, fuck, I opened this like 12 years too early and shit. Like, it was completely backward.
And that is, that can be the, sort of natural inclination for Petite Syrah to make wines like that. So for my goal has always been to harness that power, that richness, that intensity, but put together wines that are, look, I hate to reference Napa Cabernet. Mm-hmm. We're having a podcast about Paso Robles, but in a way it's like, we think about Napa Cabernet today, like a lot of these wines actually drink pretty well on release. Like you shouldn't be cracking the corks like tomorrow, but they drink well upon release, but they also age for a long period of time. Now, are they getting age as long as like, you know, a wine from the 80s? Well, like, well, shit, maybe not. Maybe they won't last 40 years. Maybe they'll only last 25. Whatever.
You know? Right.
But for us, it's about making these big, luscious, rich wines that actually drink pretty well out the gate. But hey, we just did a library tasting our Petite Syrahs the other day, all the way back to 02. Every single wine, we were trying to figure out if any of them had matured past their peak. Not a single wine. Even back to 02, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Not a single one of those wines is past their peak.
Yeah, I completely stepped over, like, I know you knew people, but you just bought some fruit, some browse. You know how to make any fucking wine.
No, I know that. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I was just literally having coffee with Justin Smith the other day, and I was talking about this. We laugh about the fact that, you know, when you were young, like when he started, you know, when he was young too, he was in his 20s. But when we started, it's like our goal at that time was like, try to get good fruit and like really just try not to fuck it up. You know, just like hang on for dear life. Like just try to make some good, clean sound wines. You venture out and you experiment and you get a little tricky here and there, but very much within the confines of like, you just don't have the experience, not the knowledge to know what's going to happen. So you play it a little bit safer. And it's only now after doing it for 20 years where you have the confidence to be like, oh, I know what I can do. I know how I can push this wine. I know where I can experiment. I know I'm not going to screw up this or that. But when you're young, you're just looking at, I just spent my life savings at $1,000 on grapes. I am not going to fuck that wine up. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm not going to go broke before the wine gets to bottle, you know? So that was, and I just feel like I'm lucky these days that some of those wines are drinking really well. Now I have more confidence 20 years later that I expect that the wines are going to be drinking really well after 20 years.
Mm.
And I'm just more grateful and surprised that the ones I made back then are still drinking killer.
So. Yeah. But like they call it happy accidents. Was like, just, you know, sometimes better have a fool on fire than like a fucking like expert, you know, because like, you stop, you get in your own way.
Yeah.
Right. You're like,
totally.
You know, and when you're young, you just go for it.
And going back to having a lack of an international benchmark, you know, there's a discomfort, in playing in that space because it's not like you got like someone to turn to. You don't got like, you can't just start cracking bottles and talking to other winemakers. They're like, I don't know, man. Like I make Petite Syrah. How do you do it? It's like, I don't know. It's just really dark and really tannic. It's actually pretty easy. You know, it's like, you don't really do that much. It's like, because they're not trying to make the kind of wines that I was trying to make. They're like, they're using Petite Syrah as a blending grape.
Right.
So they're like, just, you know, extract the piss out of it. Right, just make it. It's like, you know,
it's going to give my wine the color.
Yeah. And so we've, you know, learned a lot of things over the years, and not to say I haven't had mentorship because I've had a lot, but there's been a big experiment in kind of learning how to shape this varietal, or coax this in that shape, but let's say coax this varietal into the kinds of wines that are what we make today and what so many other producers are making, which is these big, rich, luscious wines. I mean, I always tell people, shit, for these guys that drink fucking $300 or $600, whatever, had like two $600 bottles, like Napa Cabernet the other day, someone opened for me. It's like, you know, put these wines up with those wines. I mean, these dark fruit, they're big, they're rich, they take oak really well, they last forever, they're luscious, they're loaded, top to bottom, the structures are super stacked, they're not the big, square, hollow, you know, awful green tannins of the Petite Syrahs of yore at all. I mean, these are modern, beautifully made wines that are going to live forever. And we've come a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I think a lot of that effort has only been in like the last two decades, if not less.
Well, I mean, yeah, but as we've been talking here for a minute, and I'm really thinking about like Petite Syrah, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so I think about, go back. I mean, back when I started in wine, 98, 97, 98.
Mm-hmm.
You know what my go-to bottles of wine was?
I want to know. Tell me.
Bogle Petite Syrah.
There you go.
Out of Clarksburg.
Mm-hmm.
My man, Bruno, Venom Cellars. They made Chenin and Petite Syrah out of Clarksburg.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Petite Syrah in Clarksburg.
Yeah, I think, I mean,
it's like bulky, but yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, it's central.
It's there to sturdy up again. Yeah. There to sturdy up.
But they cabinet. But like, for me, I was like, for $8, that was a really rich, full bodied red wine.
Yeah.
But I can't think about, I mean, you know, you do have, you know, you got the petite out of Lodi.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, but that's a pretty, they do a lot of that wine.
Yeah.
They make a lot of that wine. Again, so it's not on that bulky side, like
it was, yeah. You need to have, you know, you need to have those champions. You got to have people like Turley. You got to have people like Rob Vialli. Both those guys are absolute, mm, people like Morgan Freeman Peterson. These are people that are they're absolute, you know, stewards of preserving old vineyards.
Is this a new one?
No, we're gonna go to the next.
Yeah,
preserving old vineyards and keeping the legacy of yes, this grape. And again, one thing that's great about Petite Syrah, and one thing that I adore about it as well, is that it's something that we've adopted as pretty distinctively Californian.
Yes.
Much like Zinfandel, right? Yeah, yes. So we know Zinfandel's from Croatia, but who's adopted? Who's really adopted?
Right.
California. Like, California. You feel like Zinfandel's exactly a Californian grape, even though it's not.
No, I mean, but you know, I mean, like, I mean, it's, you know, we're Americans.
Yeah.
So, you know.
So Petite
Syrah. We're helping the Croatians out. Like, yeah. They're like, no, it's our grape.
Yeah. Where Petite Syrah is something that we truly get to own as like our own.
Right.
Because like people don't really grow it anywhere else. There isn't some World War example. You know, there's no one in the south of France going like, hey man, you guys are claiming Zinfandel's California. They're not going like, oh, you Petite Syrah's California. I got like this OG vineyard that we've been growing for 300. People don't have that in France, you know? So we get to be part of writing that story.
So this is something new for you, though, right?
I've been making this wine since 15. So this is the last kind of the five blends we made. This is the quote unquote the newest. This is the 21. But I started making this wine in 15, and so this was my foray into making Cabernet.
Yeah.
So Mauka, which means towards the mountains in Hawaiian. So my mother's Hawaiian, born and raised in Hawaii. I started, I was never a big fan of Paso Robles Cabernet. And so for me, it was challenging to find places in Paso Robles where I felt like Cabernet would really thrive. And one of the ways that I found that,
I'll give you 900 million reasons.
Yeah.
But maybe you should have started with Cabernet before the boys came to town.
I know. 900 billion, right? 900 billion. Yeah, exactly. But for me, you know, a big part of this, what I realized for Cabernet for me was really, you know, what, In Hawaii, they don't use cardinal directions. They basically use Mauka and Makai. Makai means towards the ocean. Mauka means towards the
mountains. I love that. Right.
And so for me, finding the Cabernet I was looking for, I had to go Mauka. I had to go towards the mountains. I had to move west where it was cooler. I had to move up into the higher elevations and get to the areas where I felt like there was a little bit more moderation in temperature. And that's where I started to find Cabernets that I was interested in. So this is a blend that is 56% Cabernet, 42% Petite Syrah, and 2% Petit Verdot. So again, taking my muse, Petite Syrah, and working it in with the blend with Cabernet. But this time actually admitting to it versus most people just put it in their Cabernet and don't say anything.
Yeah, or put a red blend.
Yeah. So I'm not ashamed of using Petite Syrah. In fact, it's what I do. So, old vine Cabernet. This is actually the oldest. I believe this is the oldest vine Cabernet in Paso Robles.
Okay,
it's all the old Bailey vineyards in Adelaide Road. Okay. It's up there. It's across the ridge from Dow. It's planted in the late 1960s. Grown on full Linicolota limestone soils. I buy the whole vineyard, and so take the oldest vine Cabernet. It's grown at about 2,000 feet. It's old vine Chenin Blanc. Might have had some of the Chenin Blanc that Loma Madrone makes.
Yep.
Same vineyard. So old vine, 1960s, late 1960s, Cabernet and Chenin Blanc. I buy all the Cabernet. Blend it with Petite Syrah and a little bit of PV.
Okay. Where's the PV from?
21, Denner.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. No longer. Sold to Gallo.
Yeah.
So those contracts got burned.
Yeah, that's quick. Like.
Yep.
They're like.
So.
They're like. Yep. Yeah. Sorry. You're like, I'm Aaron Jackson. Well, hey, Ron, you ain't getting no more fruit.
You know, more fruit for you, bro.
Yeah.
They started alphabetical on the contracts and kicked me out first.
Exactly. This is easy.
Yeah. So, PV's a fun variety to work with. In some ways, you can see why people use Petite Sirah instead of Petit Verdot as a blending grape in Cabernet blends, because it has that, can have that really square structure. But, Petite Sirah tends to have more fruit and be less green than Petit Verdot.
Right.
So Petit Verdot can have that kind of classic dilly character. Mm-hmm. So, which I think actually adds nuance to the wine. I don't mind if the PV is a little bit dilly, because there's a little bit of dill character in a blend with so much black fruit at small percentages, 2%, 3%, up to 10%. There's actually a lot of nuance and character that I dig that it brings to the blend. This year we didn't have very much Petit Verdot, so it was just really low yields in 21, so we only had to use 2%. But yeah, it's cool.
How do you decide on the blend? So, you know, I had interviewed Justin yesterday. And when you hear this, yesterday would be like 6 weeks ago. I don't fucking know everybody. But anyway, and he worked with Philippe, and he said Philippe was just the best. Philippe would just be like, it's X this, X that. Like, first go around, like when they did the jazz, like, he was like, this much then, this much Tempranillo, this much. How do you come up with your...
God, I you know, back working with Justin, watching him blend was amazing, because he's just, it was so like loose in my mind that it was like, but at the same time, like every single barrel you got in the cellar is good. It's kind of like almost no matter which way you get it. Right. It's like you make a burger, like now we're going to put some bacon, we're going to put some foie gras on it, we're going to put something like this on, put truffle, we're going to shape truffles on it. Like, is that going to taste shitty? It's like, dude, everything you're putting on there is going to be good. It's not going to taste shitty. Is it going to be the best expression of the burger? Maybe not, but it's going to taste good.
When you're talking about it's so funny. And like, it's also something that Justin said yesterday. And you said, it's so funny. Justin gave you the script and he's like, well, you know, this is the backbone.
Yeah.
And this is, but when he was talking about it, he's like, so he gave you that. This is way before he started downstream, but he's like, but when I talked to Philippe, Philippe was like, Justin, how do you do that? He's like, Justin, it's like making a sandwich.
Yeah.
You have bread. You have meat. I mean, a little mustard.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Exactly. And so I'll break down how I blend. So
yeah.
One thing that's funny about me is like, doing this for so long and being a really detailed guy, I'm actually an incredibly slow blender. Like, so slow that it's nauseating how slow I am. Really detailed. So I taste every single barrel in the cellar. Mm-hmm. We don't go by lot. We don't go by vineyard. We mix them up. Every single barrel is tasted blind.
Okay.
Two times. So it's tasted once, and it's tasted again about 6 months later. The scores are rallied. And that's just for a reference point so we can evaluate things. Then we start building blends based upon that. So every wine's supposed to have its own characteristic. I want to make sure that all five wines line up together and all taste distinctly different and all taste like they're just micro nuanced versions of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, it's about taking our best barrels of Cabernet as a base. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty simple. You taste your Cabernet. I like old school Cabernet. It tends to be a little bit more red fruited. Old school clones like 7 and 8, which tend to make these beautiful, you know, red fruited Cabernets rather than the new clones that are almost the Petite Sirah of Cabernet clones are like black super berry, dark, yeah, you know. I'm getting that already from Petite Sirah, so I have that in my pocket already. So, you know, those old school clones, nice, fresh, high acidity, nuance. I don't mind if there's, you know, I don't want green, but like if there's a mintiness to it or like that kind of classic kind of olive nuance, like I'm into that. Build that, and then you're going to just build all this color and structure from Petite Sirah. Cabernet and Petite Sirah both have pretty good acidity. Petit Verdot is just there as a kind of a nuance to it, but we just kind of layer in the wines. And what it is you put a blend together and you start somewhere and you taste it and you go, great, that tastes awesome. Where are the weak points in this wine? Well, actually, I feel like it needs a little bit more new oak. Okay, well, we want to build this wine. We want to put a little bit more new oak on it, but we don't want to lose the structure we have. So let's go through and taste the barrels we got. Are any of these wines bigger than the wine that we're already blending? Well, these three are bigger than that one. Okay, so if anything, they're going to build the blend. They're going to build the wine up to be richer than we want. Or they should equal the structure. And these also happen to be new oak. Let's try one of those in there. Ooh, that's nice. That's good. Let's try the other one. Yeah, that's good. Let's try one more. Eh, blend went too far. So it's just kind of layering. It's like, it's just building the sandwich very, very slowly.
Uh-huh,
uh-huh. And that's how we build all the wines every year. And then what we do is we put the blends aside. And then when we're all done, we put all the blends in a glass side by side. We taste them all together. We say, okay, which of these is the strongest? Which is the weakest? Which of these needs more work? And then we'll go back to the drawing board on some. Sometimes we'll scrap the whole blend and start over. So,
He listened by being on season 2 of your podcast, and he just want to walk back and forth in front of the screen. Nobody on your podcast, they go over their house. And they gotta get their ass up on the screen. I love how you do that, man. And I love you said you're a slow blender.
Yeah.
Meticulous, deliberate. Yeah.
I think that if we want to talk about blending and winemaking, like definitely blending is one of the truly artistic times to make wine.
Yeah.
Because during harvest, it's so fast paced.
Right.
You're making decisions on the fly all the time. It's not like we have time to sit with a glass of wine for, 3 hours.
Right.
So really where you...
Can you get the Zaltos, please?
Yeah. The time we get to really be slow and be creative really during that blending time. And so like any piece of artwork, I think the time to really, really slow down is during blending. That's the time when I really take my time and get really weird.
No, get really weird. That's super cool. Actually, this is like become a master study in Petite Sirah with Aaron Jackson. So fucking cool.
Yeah.
It's time. We're going to play everybody's favorite game, or at least my favorite game. That's not. Anyway. Slap, lick, fondle. Aaron Jackson.
All right.
I'm going to give 3 grapes.
Okay.
Which one you slap and which one you lick and which one you fondle. And for you, I can't do Petite Syrah. I can't do even Pinot Noir because you make incredible expressions. So I use one of these grapes, but you don't make it up. Slap, lick, or fondle. Grenache, Syrah, Mourvedre. Which one you slapping, which one you're licking, which one you're fondling.
Definitely fondling Mourved.
Wow.
Yeah. Licking Grenache for sure. Slapping probably Syrah, I guess. Going by process elimination.
Yeah, I mean, like you don't have... You have 3 choices.
Grenache is probably like my favorite grape to eat when I'm out in the vineyard. I just go until I get a stomachache. I love them. They taste so freaking good. And Mourvedre just got those... Yeah, those big plump clusters.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice.
Yeah.
And anyway, I love all those grapes.
It's not supposed to be easy. That's the whole point. It's like, how can I fuck people's heads up? So one last question as we wrap up. What are you most excited about in the future? I mean, you I'd love to hear that. What are you most excited about for the future?
It's a deep question, Jay. That's the deepest we've gone this whole time. You're getting all, as they say in Australia, you're getting all D&M on me. You're getting deep and meaningful on me. Getting all D&M, mate. What am I most excited about? I think that I have enough years in this now that maybe one of the things that in some ways that makes me the most excited about this industry and why I still love doing it after over 2 decades is that the one thing that you learn in wine over the years is that you don't know shit. And so maybe the unknown is one of the most exciting things because I don't want to feel like I figured it all out. I'm going to get bored the second that happens. So yeah, I will say I'm not excited about climate change, for example. That's the thing I'm definitely not excited about. But if we look at on the bright side of things, we know that it's going to provide us with an endless opportunity to continue to learn, and there is an unknown factor to it. And that unknown area, while maybe it's scary and intimidating, is also an opportunity for us to feel like we're always going to be learning in our careers for the rest of our lives. And it's like, it's not like, once you're an accountant, you forget how the tax code works. It's like, well, what now? It's just freaking Groundhog Day every day, So for us as winemakers, I mean, there's always going to be a new grape variety to trial. There's always going to be, new vineyards to plant and explore. There's always going to be ways to refine what we've done. There's always going to be, and we're lucky to also have that ability to be constantly nostalgically looking back at the past of what we've done before and trying to not always improve, but just change, just to be different for the sake of being different.
Yeah.
We talked about Justin earlier. I was talking about winemaking one time. He's like, dude, that was 10 years ago. I don't do any of the same shit now that I did. It's like, why not? It's like, cause that would be boring.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's true. It's like cooking food. It's like, it's always like, you want to make the same shit we've been making? No, no, no. It's like, I'm tired of all that. It's like, just learn how to make something else, you know? So as winemakers, we always kind of have that horizon that's, you know, we never really know where it's going to take us. But I think that once you get to a certain point in your career, you're less intimidated by all that stuff and you're looking at it with more like inspiration. So there we go.
Aaron, thanks, my brother. Thank you so much. Tell people where they can find you, how they can be a part of what you're doing.
Yeah, man. Come to visit us in Tin City. Got our winery taste room there. Take you in the back. Check out some barrels. Taste some Petite Syrahs. Taste a couple of Coastal Pinots. And come to see us here in Paso, man. We're the friendliest winery around town.
Ah, so true. And for all you listeners out there, first of all, thanks for dealing with the dogs, the sink, the knife cuts, the doorbells.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're doing something new. We're doing something that's never been done before. Check out the show notes. I'll list the wines we drank. I'll list Aaron's, they'll put their website, the Instagram. Make sure you follow them. You should definitely come visit them. Like I said, this is Paso. You know, I love it here. So that'll be in the show notes. And until the next time, cheers to the Mavericks. You are fucking a Maverick. Sure. 19 years old making wine. Philosopher, you know, he's Hawaiian heritage, very, very, very spiritual country and deep and respect for the land and everything. Deep thinkers, all you wine drinkers, it's your boy MJ. Peace.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you learned something and had some fun while you were here. Please subscribe to the podcast so that you are notified when a new episode drops. Also, we'd love it if you take a few seconds and give us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening on. And don't forget to go over to beetsvinesandlife.com and get on the mailing list to stay in the know.